Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, today I get the pleasure of speaking with Aniket Day, who is a PhD candidate in the Department of History at Harvard University, and already the author of a monograph published by OUP this year called The Boundary of Laughter, Popular Performances Across Borders in South Asia. Aniket, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So perhaps the first question in the minds of our many of our listeners is, how is it that you've been published even before your PhD has been completed? Could you tell us a bit about where the book project fits into your doctoral research, if they're related or different? Tell us a bit about how they're connected.
Right. Yes. I mean, by all means, it was not something that I had anticipated even when I entered the PhD. And it was sort of a series of accidents and attempts that led to it. It really began when I was an undergraduate at Tufts University. And I mentioned this at length in the book, that it was very much part of the intellectual milieu at Tufts, which is a wonderful center for South Asian studies. And I was then a double major in anthropology and history. And I started off really as an anthropologist in studying theater forms in what is now the India-Bangladesh border, and led slowly to exploring questions of nation, religion, border making, trying to blend together methods of anthropology and history as well. This is how the first draft of it was written, as these things often are, as an undergraduate honors thesis at Tufts, where I worked with major scholars, historians like Aisha Jalal, Brian Hatcher, Chris Manjapra, and others, and it came out of that very much so. Then when I went to do my PhD, it was slightly on a somewhat different topic, and initially I had thought of just making an article out of it and keeping it that way, but then I spoke to my professors and we thought that the topic is interesting. And it's a story that has not been told much. It's not a part of Bengal that is routinely studied. We are not, accustomed to looking at Bengal this way. And it lent itself, so to speak, in a book-length work. And so I expanded it. I worked on it a little bit during my first couple of years in the PhD, and guess what? It ended up as a book manuscript here. So that's the story of how the book was written. I think as far as the relation with my dissertation topic goes, it's I can talk about that a little later when we have spoken about the substance of the book. But it suffices to say that what I have been dealing as a matter of culture here in terms of cultural change and shared cultural spaces. In my dissertation, in my current work, I look at a broader angle of understanding shared political spaces across borders in much of South Asia, questions of federalism and different political spaces and so on.
Thank you for indulging the question and congratulations on having birthed the book. What this tells me is that you will definitely birth the dissertation, because all too often, or sometimes, or on occasion, on more occasion than we'd like, we have brilliant, seasoned, bright, pedigreed folks who end up ABD, because birthing a project of this size is painful and scary and et cetera, et cetera. Insert problematic adjective here. and so this says much. You know, I can't help but, you know, the life coach in me is sort of taking the wheel for a bit, but this is much about the ability to face fears, the ability to manage a very large project in small bites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So so excellent. Congratulations. Now, what's the book about?
The book, in its simplest terms, the book is about one performance tradition called Gombhira. This is a very small and localized tradition. Not many people know it, in fact, in the region beyond which it is performed. Even in Kolkata and in Dhaka, I don't think the tradition is as well known as, say, other so-called folk traditions. I found this tradition sort of when I was traveling around Bengal, trying to do some field research and surveys elsewhere, I kind of chanced upon it and then slowly kept on visiting the field site, which is Malda, and across the border, Rajshahi. And I slowly understood that there is a fascinating history of this tradition that has not been told before. I very consciously chose to write it as a history, as opposed to merely an ethnography. The difference, of course, being you follow change over time more seriously and more sustainably in history than you often do if you're just studying the present. And this was because I saw that it had a long history of starting off as an agrarian ritual, then going on to be a form of political theater. And finally, and most interestingly, in my view, after the borders were drawn in 1947, it led parallel lives as a so-called Hindu tradition on the Indian side, the theater of Shiva, and not so much a Muslim tradition, but a non-Hindu tradition, if you will, a secular tradition in some senses, where you had a Muslim peasant and his grandson taking the place of Shiva and the peasants on the Pakistan and later Bangladesh regions. And I saw this small lens, this history of a very localized, very small form of theater as a wonderful and fascinating way of studying sort of the social networks and social spaces that we don't really study, is my experience, at least in Bengal. And it also helped me to question, at the very least, if not challenge, some very paradigmatic ways of looking at the history of Bengal as a history, you know, the history of communalism, so to speak, the history of border making, the history of partition. I thought these smaller histories, read in the right way, can question some of that. This, in short, is what the book is about. It traces the history of the ritual, the theater form, from the late 19th century to roughly the...
So this particular performance tradition, for those listening who didn't quite catch it, Gombhira, what is its significance? Why is it significant? What does it shed light on?
I think, first of all, it is interesting because, okay, I should first say that I think, while I will say that it is what's unique and special about it, I think the aspect of there being shared performances across cultural and national and religious borders is not altogether unique in South Asia. And that's kind of one of my points in the book, that I have tried to develop methodology studying one tradition, but it can be applied, I think, all over India in different ways. That said, I think the unique thing about Gombhira is the fact that it is a theater that starts out as an agrarian ritual. It's part of the many Shaivite theaters and performances around Bengal. Here I must say that the performances of Shiva in Bengal, really the image of Shiva in Bengal, is very different from the Puranic Sanskritic image of Shiva as the god we have. The Bengali Shiva is an angry, lazy, fat peasant who is a henpecked husband, doesn't really like to work. He smokes weed and is quite a character in some ways, and is really a very beloved god in much of the Bengali countryside. His life is very close to that of the peasants themselves, and it's a much more of a less hierarchical relationship I have found with the image of and performances around Shiva. I think that is why the rituals around Shiva have given themselves to talk about social commentaries, political critiques, and all of that. It's a vocabulary for people who are, to use the words of the paradigm of James Scott, weapons of the weak, in some ways, to talk about people in power. But there is more. It also helps in understanding identity formation across political lines. I think the most important thing that I have tried to emphasize in studying this tradition is that it allows for making a shared cultural space beyond political borders. I think the space of Gombhira that we see across the border in some parts of Bengal, not all, it shows that, older social networks, cultural networks persist despite the drawing of borders. And in some ways, it coexists with it, so to speak. I think that's the most important significance of this.
And would you say then that overarching theme is the key takeaway, or one of the key takeaways of the book, or otherwise put, without offering a leading question, what would you hope folks would most come away with reading this book?
Right. I think absolutely. I think this is one major thing I would like readers to come away with. I think the most important thing is to pause and reconsider the relationships, the social lives of Hindus and Muslims in Bengal. I think there is, I hope people who read this book appreciate that. It's a tragedy that I think much of the stories of Hindu-Muslim relations in Bengal has been written primarily, in my understanding, through the lens of conflict, riots, partition, refugees, and so on. Now, I think those things are nonetheless real, and there are ways you have to assess them historically. But to consume the social history of these two communities, who together constitute a country, if you include the both halves of Bengal, it's a huge space. It's as large as France, I believe. If that cannot be consumed on what are, at the end of the day, isolated incidents of conflict. Historically speaking, these conflicts over the 20th century have been punctured and isolated owing to certain factors in certain times. What remains more important are these sorts of cultural and social and everyday exchanges. Gombhira being one, there are many others, but Gombhira offers, I think, a particularly compelling example in its history of Hindus and Muslims performing together, finding a way around conflicts, trying to solve conflicts. The point is not to say that there are no conflicts, it's that people try to solve them. And I think that is very clear in ritual spaces and performances of this sort. The other thing I would like people, like readers to take away is really thinking about Bengal beyond the city of Calcutta. It has been one of my regular complaints that the study of Bengal often ends up being about a very narrow study of certain aristocratic or middle classes in the city. So I very consciously distanced myself from that. And throughout the book, there's a sustained analysis of how concepts of high and low culture, folk and non-folk cultures are done through mediations between the classes in the cities and intellectuals and even actual performers and peasant performers in the rural hinterlands. So I think to be more cognizant of that, to understand that these folk performers are low caste peasants, Hindu and Muslims, and just appreciating their intellect and their political engagements as political engagements, I think is something worthy of appreciation.
Why is the book called The Boundary of Laughter?
It was to appreciate one, I think that to highlight the two key elements in the book. One is the border making process and crossing boundaries of both religious and national. And laughter, of course, is the medium that is crucial to Gombhira. I don't want to give it all away, but I think in the end of the book, you'll see that it's inspired by one of the Gombhira songs. They look at the border between India and Bangladesh and just say that this is a boundary worthy of laughing, and it's not a real boundary we care about. So that's the other small reference there. But yes, I think it's just to push people to think about national borders to think about social histories beyond political and social boundaries.
How's the book structured?
The book is structured in part as a chronological narrative. So there are five chapters. The first one starts from the 19th century, and we progressively move. The second one, I think, on the early nationalist period in the Swadeshi movement of 1905 to 1914. The third on the interwar years, the fourth on partition, and the fifth on the post-colonial period. So that's a sort of a classic historian's way of periodizing books in different segments. But that's not all. I have in fact tried something slightly different here, which is I juxtapose ethnographic sections with historical sections in each chapter. This was a conscious choice because partly it was a way to blend the methodologies, because think about it, if we are doing just history and anthropology, one way of doing it is you end up concentrating all the anthropological work in the last chapter. Now that does no one any good, I think, especially when you're trying to make an argument about the dynamic interactions between past and present, how it lives on and on. That is why you will see each chapter, which are especially in thematics of it, say in the second chapter, when I discuss the nationalist, let's say the Swadeshi, I shouldn't really say nationalist in the modern sense. It was the Swadeshi anti-colonial making of Gombhira as a new tradition. Some Calcutta intellectuals played a major role in it. I have done extensive archival work on that chapter with periodicals, writings, and so on. But I've also given examples of performers today, how they remember that moment and how they think of that heritage, both in West Bengal and Bangladesh. So this is something you'll find in each chapter. But broadly, it's a chronological narrative with attention to the past and the dynamic relation between past and present.
The process of uncovering this data or investigating this tradition, was there anything striking or surprising to you? Was it a case of, you know, most of your hunches confirmed through the empirical data? Or was it the case that the data took you in a direction different from the one you had envisioned at the outset?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was the latter. There were the process of research and working on this was full of surprises. You know, when I first began working on it, I was mainly interested in sort of let's say the age-old religion and modernity paradigm, right? In the sense of what is the role of the theater of Shiva in the present day world? This is the kind of question I had gone in with. And then when I began speaking to, because first of all, when I first saw performances, the first thing that struck me was that, you know, when you imagine a theater of a religious theater in South Asia, so to speak, you often have presumptions of what kind of things it will be. It will be devotional, for example, or it will be performances of myths. These are stereotypes you have, especially as an undergraduate who's starting out. But when I first saw Gombhira, what struck me was the political angle. It was a political performance form. And while Shiva was very, you know, it was a beloved character and a god, that was not the major point of the performance at all. And everyone in the region knew this. So that drew me to more of the politics, the political side of it. And then suddenly I discovered the entire angle of the border. This was quite a surprise because I think, and I mentioned this, whatever secondary literature exists, I believe it's all in Bangla. The only English language work on the tradition was published in 1917 by Binoy Kumar Sarkar. And there is a fascinating story about anti-colonialism and the making of that book. But apart from it, the literature remains entirely in Bangla, produced mostly from Malda and from Dhaka. Now, these are folklorists who have done excellent work in compiling and you know, providing descriptions, but they have not really taken an analytical angle, especially taking the other side of the border into account. So if you read literature, the Bengali books produced in West Bengal, you would have no idea that Gombhira is performed in Bangladesh as well, and vice versa. So when I was finally able to gather the material and sit back from it, I realized that the most surprising thing here was the connection between the two sides, which puts a completely different angle on how to study these folk traditions, right? These are not sort of remnants from the past stuck in one corner of India or Bangladesh. These are parts of social lives that continue across. Yes, these were some of the surprises that came up in the course of my work.
Fascinating. Where does this work fit into your current research, or otherwise put, however you like to answer that?
Right. No, I think this remains a very formative project for me, and I think this was one reason I thought of you know, putting in time and energy to write this book separately from my doctoral dissertation. Because I thought, I think just thinking of one's intellectual genealogy is important. And a lot of my insights into borders and social spaces and the ability, say, of Hindus and Muslims, bluntly put, in South Asia to live together, this was a very organic realization for me that came in the course of researching this book. This is not something that the scholarship of 20th century India tells us. For many reasons, I think for various reasons, because we have taken partition as an inevitable end or whatever, or we have looked back at the history of colonial India through lenses after partition. For whatever reason, I think if one builds from the scholarly literature alone, one would not pay enough attention, I think, to this sort of, you know, the shared element of social spaces. But this became very clear to me on the course of writing this this book. And I was then interested more into questions of federalism, federalism in South Asia, federalism not in the constitutional sense in which we talk about federalism of, you know, basically narrow and technical relations between center and the states, but federalism as an ethical and political ideology of multiple nations living in one state, right, living together. And this sort of calls into question both, you know, questions of religious majoritarianism of a country, whether India or Pakistan being countries of Hindus or Muslims exclusively. Now, there were these ideologies and they remain strong in some ways, but I think there was and remains a very strong socially grounded tradition of what I call federalist thinking, anti-colonial federalist thinking to be precise, which did insist, and in fact, in many ways, even, you know, implemented and executed possibilities of religious communities transcending differences in some ways. So as I mentioned in the very beginning, the Gombhira project is a much smaller. I defined the boundaries of that project in a small, manageable format. In the dissertation, I have cast a larger net, so to speak, thinking of federalism as a, you know, subcontinental ideology, thinking of how, and there, you know, picking representative figures from India, from Punjab, from South India, and saying how political space, the ability to form shared political spaces between Hindus and Muslims against the colonial order was showing up. And that's what my dissertation is trying to do. So that's in some ways how it fits into to my broader work.
So then what subfields might this research impact? Otherwise put, who might most be interested in this work, in this book?
I think the book, first and foremost, I think the scholars of Bengal, any aspect, and then scholars of modern Bengal, especially of religious histories, I think, you know, there have been major scholars who have done work on the side of religious studies, I think, who have built on this. I must mention, say, the work of Tony Stewart, who has worked on the early modern period, absolutely foundational work, rethinking the relations between Hindus and Muslims from a literary angle in the early modern period. In the modern period, you have Jean Openshaw's work on the bowels of Bengal. Again, wonderful study, ethnographic work, in West Bengal on very similar lines. So I actually I come from that tradition of studying Bengal. And I think, but those works, I think they have been confined early, mostly to the early modern period or strictly to questions of religious studies and anthropology, not so much to history. So I think, just using some of those insights to rethink the history of modern Bengal, both for historians of West Bengal and Bangladesh, that's in many ways an immediate audience of the book. The secondary audience is, of course, broader scholars of borderlands in South Asia. Here, there has been, I think there's the work of Willem van Schendel and others following him, studying the makings of post-colonial borders. I have tried to suggest that it's not enough to consider only to say the state actions on borders, policing, military, and so on. That's how, when you say borderland, those are the images that comes to people's minds, and that's where the scholarship really goes, smuggling and other legal aspects of borders. I think the cultural question is really crucial, precisely because language and culture in Bengal, as in elsewhere in South Asia, doesn't really map on directly to the scholars to the categories of nations, national borders. And finally, I think there is an appeal for both historians and anthropologists to juxtapose archival and ethnographic work more seriously and carefully. Especially, I think folk traditions are often assumed not to have histories. And in some cases, yes, they're oral traditions, but a tradition is made from very different parts and very different sources. And this is where a historical method really is useful. So if you see the book, there are references to the unlikeliest of places where you can find a folk traditions. I'll come back to Binoy Kumar Sarkar, who wrote this, who's really a character in himself. He was a major anti-colonial figure who moved all around the world during the First World War. And he was one of the key figures of the anti-colonial movement in India elsewhere, but also the man from Malda who helped restructure the performance in his own village. This shows the way he restructured it into new theater form, it continues to this day. So that leaves a lasting legacy to the performance form. This is just one example of how doing broad scale archival work on even so-called low folk traditions can actually reveal a lot. I think methodologically, this might be of some interest to many social scientists.
Is it fair to say you're issuing a call for the cross-pollination of historical and anthropological methods in general in the field?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, of course, I don't claim that I'm the only one saying or doing this at all. Historians and anthropologists have, I think, been in conversation for a very long time. And many anthropologists I know also do serious archival research, and some historians have started doing some field work as well. I think my point is to think more critically about this relationship. Sometimes anthropologists have a tendency in some anthropological works to take so-called native voices at face value. I try not to do that, and I try to sort of historicize their voices and in specific social and political contexts. On the other hand, historians sometimes have a tendency to just ignore all archives other than some things they define professionally for their own fields. And this is, and in some ways, being able to write this book without the strictures of say a dissertation or say even a professional monograph for tenure or whatever, actually allowed me the freedom to do this sort of work, which I've enjoyed immensely. I think, for instance, I could define what an archive was based on manuscript sources and was able to juxtapose history and anthropological methods in a way that might have faced, let's say, more professional resistance in certain quarters. And that was one thing that I enjoyed a lot.
Now, if you would permit me, I'd like to ask a slightly more personal question. Yes. Nothing scandalous.
No.
I ask this question because you're currently in the middle of your PhD or near the end of it, somewhere towards the end of it. Do you have a sense of what you might like to do post PhD? What's the dream?
Yes, I would like to, be teach and do research and remain in the academic field. That's the goal. Hopefully in a history department, if I manage to secure a job, and then continue with this sort of work. That's the plan, so to speak.
Excellent. There's much to be said about the job market in humanities and history and religious studies. And of course, that is the conversation for another day. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
All right, the pleasure was mine. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Harvard history PhD candidate Aniket Day on his brand new OUP monograph, The Boundary of Laughter. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, and keep contemplating boundaries, however rigid or porous they may be. Take care.